Okay, hope you got a handout. Time for us to dive in. Holy Spirit class is beginning right now, but for us, this is actually class number two. So our first class, we did an introduction to what's happening in this class. This class is called Being Human. The point of this Sunday school class is to work at understanding who we are, interact with the view of the world around us, and then be filled with gospel hope. So those three things in each part of our lessons. Who are we from a biblical standpoint? How has the world messed that up and think wrongly about that? And where is our hope in the gospel? So get some truth, get the twisted lie, remind ourselves of the gospel reality. Because the better you understand what God says about humanity, the more you'll be able to live worshipfully and resist the lies and prize the gospel. So being human. And we've said our first time after we introduced the class, being human means that we are created. So who we are is created. But we're not just created, we are created and sinners. Lord willing, next week we'll get into we are sufferers and saints. But today, the second part of that first lesson, we are created and we are sinners. Before I get to that, I'm always happy to offer resources and recommendations. I recommended a book in that first class called Reenchanting Humanity by Owen Strachan that does a better job that what I'm trying to do in this class. He does a better job in written form, so you can always just grab that book. I want to give kind of a maybe an interesting resource. It's actually a study guide called Who Am I? It's a study guide by David Platt in a ministry called Secret Church. How many of you ever heard of Secret Church? All right, so a smattering. Now you know, it's not a secret anymore. All right, David Platt's one of those names. David Platt's a Southern Baptist. There's some elements of controversy surrounding the name David Platt. I'm not even getting get into all of that. Here's what I'd say about David Platt. Secret Church is essentially a day of teaching. It's about, is it 8 hours, 9 hours? Where teaching is then interspersed with prayer for the persecuted church. Say whatever else people want to say about David Platt. I have never heard someone teach for 8 hours nonstop without even saying an accidental heresy or an accidental and fast. And like flying through the Bible with incredible precision and accuracy. Kathy and I have loved every Secret Church event that we have either hosted or gone to. There, that's what I'd say about that. This is the study guide from the one that he did on humanity. So who am I? You can find the actual, like the 8 hours of teaching are still like available online. You could get the answers because this one's blank. But let me just give you a taste. This is 200 pages and this is just from the Secret Church event. Basically what he does is he just teaches through this material. So who am I? What is wrong in the world? How can it be made right? How can we experience the good life? And then contemporary applications, humanity and sexuality, humanity and race, humanity and abortion, humanity and fertility and artificial reproductive technology, humanity, genomics and eugenics, humanity and artificial intelligence, humanity, digital and social media, and the metaverse. All right, so that's what's in this. It's fantastic. The teaching's fantastic. These are just left over from the event that Kathy and I hosted. So this is how many I have. If you want one, like I said, there are some blanks in here, but the answers are all available online. You just go to all the answers if you wanted to go through and fill it out. So feel free to help yourself to these. These are free. These are just take one if you think that would, if that interests you. So I want you to let you know that I think that the Secret Church recording on Who Am I is well worth your time. I'm recommending it as a resource, even though I don't necessarily recommend everything about David Platt, but I'm not trying to recommend everything. I'm trying to recommend something specific. Okay, all right. Sinner, created and sinners. Sinner does not just describe what you do. Sinner describes who we are. The fall universally altered what it means to be human. So I said that last time I said that your createdness is at the very heart of being human. The fact that you are created is at the very heart of being human. I am created. But what happened in the fall universally altered what it means to be human. It was a design change. And that design change means that you and I are now, properly speaking, we were sinner, We are now, if we are saved, we are sinner saint, right? And we'll get to, you'll have to wait till next week when we talk about sufferers and saints, because the reality is that saints, only Christians can be all four of these. Only Christians are created in sinners, sufferers, and saints. Unbelievers are created in sinners and sufferers, but they don't have the saint one, right? But sinner altered what it meant to be human. What Adam said sin did, it did to it altered creation. It affected us physically and it affected us spiritually. So that's what I want to talk through. When we think about the biblical truth about us as sinners, let's think about what Adam's sin did to creation. The fall, as recorded in Genesis 3, severely damaged all of creation, not just Adam and Eve. God cursed the entire earth as punishment on Adam's sin. So sin affected creation by ruining the perfect way that the earth worked. It brought suffering and death to creation, neither of which existed before Adam's sin, which is another reason we argue so strongly for the literal understanding of Genesis 1. Because any other understanding, even theistic evolution or any other kind of atheistic evolutionary belief, teaches that death preceded Adam's fall, right? Because you have to evolve to get to an Adam, or even in theistic evolution, you have to have millions of years of death before you get to Adam and Eve. But the biblical record is that death is introduced through sin, which comes through Adam and Eve, right? That's when death enters into this perfect existence. And so you have two realities in our creation because of Adam's sin. You have frustrating futility and you have daily death. Frustrating futility. If you want to go to Romans 8, you can follow along with Paul's presentation of what's broken in our world. Here's what he says. Verses 18 through 22. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation, so notice we're talking not just people, we're talking what Adam said into creation. The creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation, you hear the broad language in this, right? All of creation was subjected to futility. That's why I called it frustrating futility. Creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, and hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. Now, that's talking about creation. Verse 23 turns the focus on humanity. Not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. The point is that creation has been subjected by the sovereign God to futility because of Adam's sin. Essentially, our world is broken. Constant suffering that people endure in the brokenness of our earth is because of sin. The future kingdom, heaven, is going to be so wonderful, Paul says here in Romans 8, that even God's creation is anxious for it to arrive. Even creation itself, metaphorically, can't wait to get past all of the brokenness and the way this earth is falling apart and degenerating until finally Jesus returns and sets all things right, and then even creation itself is liberated to work the way it originally worked back in the garden, back when there was no sin on the earth, but essentially when the curse is brought to an end. Creation itself was cursed to a miserable and futile existence after Adam's sin. So nothing on our earth works exactly the way God made it to. I don't think I have to argue too hard on that point, right? I think we can all agree. That's a pretty self-evident statement. Sin has ruined plants and animals, the physical world we live in. What Paul is saying here in Romans, and in Romans 8, is essentially he's picturing earth as like a frustrated child who can't accomplish a task. So it's very new in our family, but Luca has just learned to tie his shoes. Now, I don't know if you remember when you had to learn to tie your shoes or if you tried to teach somebody else how to tie their shoes, but not being able to do a task is really frustrating. And for a child, when you say, now it's time to tie your shoes and they can't do it, there were plenty of moments, and sometimes still are moments, of tears and I can't do this and this is so hard and I don't like this, right? Well, that's an example of shoe tying, which maybe was, you know, for younger children. But think about that sense of I'm trying to do a task and I can't get it done. That's how the whole earth feels. I'm trying to function and it's as if something is broken. Well, it's because of sin. There is this frustrating futility. All right. One helpful way I think you could see the contrast between our present earth and God's original purpose is to understand what the Bible teaches about the perfect earth that's coming. So if you want to see the contrast between the way things are and the way things they're originally designed to be, just look at how things will be one day. And we're told some amazing things about the future. The Bible talks about a kingdom that Jesus will build on earth, and it describes these amazing realities, even about nature. Amos describes plants growing so fast that it's as if the person who harvests the crops is catching up to the person who's planting them. It's this beautiful description of you put the seed in the ground and poof, it grows, and the guy behind you is like picking or harvesting the fruit, and he catches up to the guy that's planting. It's a picture of an earth that is bountiful and productive, and it's working the way it's supposed to. Now, things like drought ruins crops, or things like too much rain at the wrong time ruins crops, or any number of other things ruins crops. Plants wither and die and only produce a really small crop. Our earth is insufficient and broken. It is met with futility, not just futility, but daily death. Sin brought death to creation itself. Paul says in Romans, here in Romans 8:21, it says that it is in bondage to corruption. There is this daily death. The earth has been chained to suffering and death ever since Adam sinned. The earth is suffering from the crippling effects of pain and death. And this is the reality. Again, if you want to see the contrast, even in how our world works right now in terms of creation, things like animals eating other animals, which might be interesting to watch on the Discovery Channel, but is not going to be interesting to watch in eternity because this is not the way it was originally designed to work. Right? Think about this. Like, animals weren't eating other animals in the garden because there was no death, all right? So I had a friend once, maybe I've shared this before, I had a friend once that said, the only conclusion I can come to then is that steak is gonna grow on trees in heaven because there's no way, like, how could you not eat meat, right? I don't know, I can't imagine that either, but the point is this was not part of the original design. Think about the future kingdom where you have a description of the lion laying down with a lamb. Like, why is that the description? Well, because things are restored to their position of peace. And if you put a lamb next to a lion nowadays, that he's going to have some, you know, he's going to have some shish kebabs, right? Or he's going to eat it. It describes children being able to play with poisonous snakes, put their hand into the hole of the adder and not get bit. Why? Because it's this return to original design that just shows you that now our world is marked by death. So that's our physical world. It's growing older and older every day. It's wearing out a little bit more. Psalm 102:26, you have all these catastrophes. So Adam's sin had an effect on our entire creation. It also had an effect on us physically, right? Adam's sin brought suffering and death to humanity. So now, because of Adam's sin, you have unavoidable suffering and you have certain death. This is part of what it means to be human. They're like, oh, nothing like, I warned you. I told you could go to the Holy Spirit class, right? Here's the cheery message this morning. Because you are human, suffering is unavoidable, and your death is certain. Now look, even joking about, like, that's not a super positive message to hear this morning, there are plenty of people in our world that say, I don't want to hear that, la, 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 and they just act as if we can somehow avoid the certainties of death or this, we can get around suffering. Listen, not saying the reality does not make life better for anybody. It's like the proverbial, like, the emperor's new clothes. Like, I mean, it's the little kid that goes, he's not wearing any clothes that's right. When Christians go, suffering is unavoidable, we're not being pessimistic, we're not being negative. When we say death is certain, we're saying what is real, what should be self-evident. And part of the reality of being human is this unavoidable suffering and certain death because of sin, because we are sinners. Part of God's judgment on Adam was to introduce the suffering and even frustration to his work. So if you go back to Genesis 3 and you have this original curse, here's where this suffering is even stated, and it's in its like curse form and its beginning form. To Adam, he said, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Wrapped up in that curse is both these ideas of suffering and of certain death, right? In pain, he says, the ground is cursed. In pain, you shall eat of it. Right? This is the reality. There is this unavoidable suffering. Work became difficult and painful instead of enjoyable. It's right for us to note that the curse was not, now you have to work, right? Adam was already working before the curse. The curse wasn't work. The curse was suffering and pain. It is now to the point where it is impossible for you to even think about life without pain. Like, there's no such thing as life without elements of pain. Pain and bruises and sicknesses and sadness, all of those are the results of Adam's sin and the fact that you and I as humans are sinners. Of course, it's not just on Adam. Eve's judgment also involved pain and suffering, right? So the woman, he said, I will surely multiply your pain and childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. That's a specific kind of suffering, but my point is that suffering is unavoidable, whether we are male or female, living in a broken world because we are sinners. And also think about the great contrast to what we experience now. Think about places like Revelation 21:4, and that's why our future hope is so wonderful, because he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither there shall be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. Right? There's an element of gospel hope that I'm already like weaving into this, right? There's a day coming when Jesus makes all this go away, which just reminds us of how much suffering there is now. Can you imagine a day, let alone a week, that you go through without some element of mourning? Without some element. Do you even go through one day without some element of a sense of loss? Maybe you get through a day and it was a positive day and nobody seemed to have any hardship around you. Yeah, everybody in your family was doing fine. You felt fine. But if you managed to have one of those days, I would be shocked if you said, I have multiple of those days in a row where there isn't some element of pain or loss or suffering. So when Revelation 21 tells us he's going to wipe away every tear, and death shall be no more, there will not be any more mourning, no crying, no pain anymore. Can you imagine going through a day without pain? Well, maybe some of you youngsters, maybe you know what it is to go through a day without pain. Maybe. But just give yourself a little bit of time. And sometimes the pain starts when you just like wake up, right? And you get out of bed and you're like, ah, why does my elbow hurt? Oh yeah, because I slept on that other pillow that wasn't as soft, you know? And I'm like, why does that happen? I don't know. And then you go through the day and you bang your shin on the coffee table. It hurts, right? You shut the car door on your finger. I don't know, like you do something, you experience pain, and Jesus is coming, he's gonna say, no more pain. This suffering for us now is unavoidable. Our human bodies are wearing out over time. They're wasting away with age. And that unavoidable suffering leads to the greatest version of physical suffering, which is death. Hebrews 9:27 again tells us this is what it means to be human. This is what it means to be sinner. It is true for everyone. Doesn't matter your age or ethnicity or gender. It is appointed for man to die once. And after that comes judgment. This is what it means to be human. This is appointed to humanity. You're going to die, right? Super cheery message this morning. We have no way of knowing what life would have been like for Adam if he had not sinned, but we do know that death started after Adam sinned and it became a universal reality for everyone who is human. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is? It's death. This is reality. Death is what people who sin have earned. Without sin, there would be no death. And thanks to Adam's sin and all of our sin, every human body dies. And yet, death is another one of these disastrous consequences that Jesus will eliminate in eternity. He'll eliminate this in heaven. No more death, right? This is wonderful good news for us because we know this reality. Death for us is certain. Also, Jesus promises, I'll bring an end to death and I'll grant you everlasting life. So, Adam's sin, what it means for us to be sinners, affects us physically, but there are also these profound impacts spiritually. So Adam's sin and our sin does not just affect our bodies, it has these massive spiritual consequences. So the spiritual component of us is not visible like our physical body is, but the damage is just as real. So just because you can't see the spiritual side of you doesn't mean it's any less damaged than the physical side of you. It's what it is to be human, to be corrupted spiritually even. And that spiritual ruin is in many ways worse than the physical damage. Adam's sin will do just two things about our reality spiritually. We're born sinners and we're guilty and punishable. All right, we're born sinners. Every person has inherited a sinful nature because of Adam's sin. David wrote about this in the Old Testament, Psalm 51:5, Psalm 58:3. Sinners, well, I'll just read both of them because this is not just some kind of like New Testament concept. This is certainly not some kind of like, oh, the reformers invented this idea. No, this is the biblical reality from Old Testament to New, Psalm 51:5. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me. He wasn't saying that his mother was in some kind of adulterous relationship. He was saying, from the moment of conception, I was a sinner, right? You are a sinner by virtue of being human. So if you are in the category of human, then you are automatically in the category of sinner. You can't separate those. You can't distinguish those. There's no such thing as human who is not sinner. It is necessary. The only exception being Jesus through the divine power of virgin birth, right? And what God has done, Jesus is the only one that gets to be human and not sinner. So that's Psalm 51:5. Psalm 58:3 again paints this just so flattering picture of us. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray from birth, speaking lies. This is a reality from the womb. From conception, we just naturally go the way of sin. We're born sinners. So it both these things are true. I think these are both theologically accurate statements. You're a sinner because you sin, but you sin because you're a sinner, right? It's not either or. You say like, well, which one is it? Both things are true. You're a sinner because you sin. You've made choices to sin. When you had an opportunity to do right, you chose wrong. When you should have done what was right, you didn't do it. Whether it's omission or commission, you're a sinner because you do sinful things, but you sin because you're a sinner. It's just in our nature, right? Just like you're alive because you've been breathing and your heart's been beating, as a human, you're also a sinner. We're born this way. This is our reality. We're born not basically good and needing instruction on how to do the right thing, but we're born, Paul would tell us, hating God and incapable of doing what's right in his eyes. That's how bad the situation is. You are born as a God-hater, and it is not even possible for you to do what's right. I've said it probably a variety of times, but nobody ever has to teach a child how to lie or disobey or be selfish. It's just hardwired in there. Right? You don't have to model to a kid how to lie. They'll just do it automatically. Why? Because they're human, which is to say they're sinner. All right. Adam and Eve never taught Cain how to murder. Cain had never seen a murder. Cain had never had an example of a murder. He didn't follow his dad's footsteps to be a murderer, right? Why did Cain murder? Because it was in his heart, because this is what sin is. It's built in. It's hardwired in. All right. So, the human heart is tricky, Jeremiah 17:9, deceitful is what it says, and incurably sick. That's what Jeremiah 17:9 is. The human heart is incurably sick. It's deceitful above all things. We're a sinner. All right. Romans 3:10, 18 is another one of those passages that just list off how bad we really are. I'll let you look at that later on your own if you want. But Romans 3 has just this list of here's how impossibly bad we are. So we are born sinners. We are hence guilty and punishable. So here's Romans 5. I'll read Romans 5, 12 to 19. So if you want to jump over there, I did a couple passages here in Romans. So if you're still there, you can just kind of hop around. Romans 5, 12. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was the type of one who was to come. There has always been this dying. Everyone has been guilty. It says, if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift by the grace of that one man Jesus abounded for many. The free gift is not like the result of that one man's sin. For the judgment following one trespass brought condemnation.
This is the reality of guilty and punishable. We are condemned because of Adam's one trespass. But the free gift following many trespasses brought justification. Here's Paul's argument. If, because of one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. It's really a glorious parallel that we would lose if we didn't believe that Adam's sin touched all of us. If you reject the truth that Adam's sin touches all of you, then what you unwittingly do is reject the truth that Jesus' righteousness can also apply to us. Right? You actually undercut your gospel hope that Jesus can save you because you don't believe that somebody else's actions can be imputed to you, can be put on your account. Here's the thing. Adam's actions are put on your account. You are a sinner. And you go, I don't like that. Okay, Jesus' actions can be put on your account. Ah, there's good news. Oh, yes. Praise God for this idea that someone else's actions can be put on my account. We are guilty and punishable because of Adam's sin and then the way that we live out that same nature. All right, the point is that the fall brought death and ruin to everything God made that had been good. Whether we're talking creation, plants, animals, the earth, and every one of us as humans, we suffer and die because Adam sinned, because we sin. Adam's sin ruined all of creation. And all that terribly bad news is met triumphantly with the good news that is in Jesus. So Adam made all of us sinners. Jesus can make us righteous. Adam's one act of sin doomed the planet. Jesus, one act of obedience on the cross, rescued all who believe in him. And one day, Jesus is going to completely undo all of the destruction caused by sin and is create a perfect world for his children once again. This is good gospel hope for you and for me today. However, our world doesn't want to admit that this is the reality. And I think there are two versions of the twisting, as we talk about worldviews, there's two versions of the twisting that says we can be sin-free. One is secular and one is religious. And both are particularly dangerous. So whereas you should be convinced from the text that you are sinner because you are human, there are plenty in our world that don't want to acknowledge the existence of sin or how bad it is. Our world wants to think about being sin-free. The secular vision of sin-free can go along several different lines. One version of the secular vision of sin-free essentially says morality is just something that we create. It's a human-created construct. Therefore, there actually is no other such thing as immorality. Sin is simply a function of human interaction or human imagination. So sin is just a social construct. Therefore, you don't actually sin. This is just culture or tradition or heritage or, you know, the secular version might even say that if you believe in sin, you believe in some kind of oppressive, restrictive nonsense. Right? The secular vision of sin-free wants to minimize sin and essentially say, as long as you don't do anything that violates the rights of anyone else, you actually are not sinner. I think that's the way of summarizing the world's worldview about morality is essentially, as long as what you do doesn't affect anyone else's rights, you can do whatever you want to do, right? You can see this, I know this is kind of it's an unfortunate example, but this is one of the reasons that our world has been pushing, even in terms of sexuality, it's why it's been pushing things like age of consent and pedophilia, like younger and younger, and even wanting to eliminate that, because of what our world wants to say is, you're not actually harming anyone else, and as long as you're not harming anyone else, you can do whatever you want, including things that we have all understood to be sinful for a very long time, right? So essentially, if our world can convince itself that an action doesn't harm someone else, then our world wants to make that legal and acceptable, right? This was some of the push for back when homosexual marriage was a big push. It's not hurting anybody. Why are you goofy people resisting this? Like, it's not doing damage to anyone. So just let people be, let them do what they want to do. As long as what they do doesn't harm you, then it should be fine. What I'm saying is the ultimate value is, you know, essentially this claim that it's about human rights. Now, I don't think that's true because that's not how the world works. Inevitably, every belief system contradicts a different belief system and somebody has to pay the price for that. Where our world's going right now is that Christians should pay the price for that. Like, you can't be as intolerant or as whatever. Like, your rights are going to get stepped on all the time. But the secular vision of sin-free is just do no harm.
and therefore there is no other sense of morality. But there's a religious version of sin-free that I also want us to talk about today and make us aware of. The religious version of sin-free, several different streams of this has come in. Most popular, if we were to talk like the pop level of the religious version of sin-free in today's world, it would be an example of someone like Joel Osteen. Now, I'm not picking Joel Osteen because he's low-hanging fruit. I'm picking him because he's pop level, and you need to understand like the thought process. Like, I don't know if you have ever listened to Joel Osteen, if you've read anything by him, but literally tens of thousands of people do. Like probably hundreds of thousands of people do. You ought to wonder, like, what is interesting about this man? What is attractive about this message? Like, why? You should ask why. If you are a person that loves Joel Osteen, then I think we need to have, I think we need to work through several different theological things. If you're somebody that's like, Joel Osteen, blah, you need to like stop the blah and go, but why? Like, what is it? What's behind this? One of the things that's behind this is a different guy by the name of Schuller. Well, Schuller taught this, and this is absolutely, Joel Osteen has like publicly said, I'm following Schuller's teaching. Here's what Schuller said. Sin is any act or thought that robs myself or another human being of his or her self-esteem. That's what Schuller taught sin was, robbing somebody else of their self-esteem. This is what he said. Jesus never called a person a sinner. Rather, he reserved his righteous rebuke for those who used their religious authority to generate guilt and cause people to lose their ability to taste and enjoy their right to dignity. He's redefining sin, including what he says Jesus said sin was. What we need is to positivize the words that have only had a negative connotation. There is no greater damage, this is a direct quote, there is no greater damage that can be done than to refer to the lost sinful condition of man. But he says we need to positize these words. We need to have a more positive message. Osteen dove into Schuller's teaching and he said, this is right. Osteen just did a better job marketing it and presenting it, this positive image. So the whole like him even saying like on, I think it was on Larry King, where Joel Osteen said, like, I just don't find the need to ever talk about sin. I don't ever need to say that word. Right? He just openly said that. You go like, well, that seems kind of strange. What's behind that? Well, Schuller's teaching was behind that, right? This is negative language. It's not positive enough for us. So we need to change these words. All right, here's another quote from Schuller. I don't think anything has been done in the name of Christ and under the banner of Christianity that has proven more destructive to human personality and hence counterproductive to the evangelism enterprise than the often crude, uncouth, and unchristian strategy of attempting to make people aware of their lost and sinful condition. All right? Like, I mean, that was a long quote, but nothing has been more damaging, he says. It's destroyed human personality, and so it's counterproductive to evangelizing, this crude and uncouth and unchristian strategy of trying to tell people that they're sinners, they're lost and sinful condition. I think that is the twisting. It is the twisting of what the Bible says, is that you and I as humans are sinners. You can't have both of these. There are two contradictory religious visions that are being presented here this morning. You are either willing to accept that you are a sinner and everyone else is by virtue of being human, or you say that is damaging to the human psyche. It's bad for our self-esteem. We need to reclaim these words. We're destroying people's personality by telling them that this is who they are. And what I'm arguing this morning is you aren't able to understand who you are until you come face to face with this reality, as ugly as it is. You and I were born sinners, dead in our sin, lost, on our way to certain death physically, and certainly being dead spiritually. And all of that sets you up to be able to receive the good of Ephesians 2. You were dead in your trespasses and sins, right? So what Schuller argues and what Osteen argues is that this is counterproductive to evangelism. It's gaslighting. It's the exact opposite of the truth. You cannot evangelize people that have no need to be saved. You can't evangelize. You can't tell them there's good news. You already told them that they weren't a sinner. So what kind of good news do they need to hear? There is no good news. Here's the good news. You were dead. but God made you alive. Oh, now there's good news. Now there's actually evangelism that can happen because you were dead, but God, through his grace and not through your works, has made you alive. All right, I said I was picking on that. I wanted to take that because of the pop version that is in our world. I'm not at all suggesting that this was in any way like new or no one has ever taught in church history before. John Wesley openly and clearly taught sinless perfectionism. So any number of churches that are Wesleyan in tradition, so we're talking some churches of Christ, we're talking Nazarene churches, still to this day openly teach sinless perfectionism. Some Pentecostal churches, like the Church of God, still teach a version of Wesleyan perfectionism. One of the things and so we're talking like, this is much older than Joel Osteen, this is not pop, but here's what Wesley said. We believe that entire sanctification is that work of the Holy Spirit by which the child of God is cleansed from inherited depravity and empowered for more effective service through faith in Jesus Christ. It is subsequent to regeneration and is accomplished in a moment of time when the believer presents himself a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. The Spirit-filled believer is thus enabled to love God with an undivided heart. There's a lot in there. You go like, well, that sounds good, but what's built in there is it's possible for you to then become sinless. It's possible you, when they say undivided heart, what they mean is never ever sinning in your heart. And never sinning in motivation nor in action. I remember the Nazarene pastor at the church that I came from. I didn't come from a Nazarene church. The town that I came from, down in Kingsburg, there was a Nazarene church in town. And he openly would say from the pulpit that it had been over 25 years since he had last sinned. And I was like, I feel like saying that is maybe like, I think maybe that's sinful. But this was like what was publicly acceptable to say in their church and for people to practice. We had people that came to our church from the Nazarene church. And you want to know how hard it was for them to grapple with this question, this very hard question, what do you do when a believer sins? They had no rubric for that because what they were told is good Christians don't sin. So they had no way of actually assessing their heart, because as soon as they looked in their heart, maybe they looked at their actions and they felt good about their actions, which inevitably those are going to fail you too, right? But as soon as they started going to a deeper level, they started considering their heart and things like anger and lust and jealousy and envy and all these things that are happening in their heart, they didn't know what to do with it because they were told Christians don't sin. And now you can do one of two things. You can just look away. Let's just act like our hearts are not sinful, and let's just pretend that motivations don't matter. Let's just pretend that only external actions are the only things that are sinful. Or you can conclude what? I'm a sinner, and if you're in a Wesleyan tradition, then you're not only just a sinner, you're what? You're an unbeliever. You're lost, right? Those are your only conclusions if you come from some kind of perfectionistic culture. Either ignore it or conclude, I'm actually not a Christian. So as soon as you sin, what does it do to you? It destroys any amount of hope, of faith. You don't have any sense of conviction. You're constantly paralyzed because we're constantly sinning. And so you're constantly going like, oh, I guess what I've proved again this week is I guess I'm not really a Christian. And when you keep saying that over and over again, I guess I'm not really a Christian, then eventually you just kind of shrug your shoulders and you're like, all right, it must be true. I'm not a Christian. Why do I even try at this point, right? As opposed to where we'll get to, as we talk about, we're created in sinners and we are sufferers, but we are also saints. All right, here's a gospel reality to remind us of. I tried to weave some gospel realities all throughout this lesson, but here's the gospel reality that I hope is good news for your heart this morning. The gospel is for sinners. The gospel is for sinners. No sinners, no need for a gospel. So here's what I'm convinced of. If you are in the category of human, you are in the category of sinner. It is impossible to be human without being sinner. But here's wonderful news for you. If you are in the category of sinner, then you are in line for good news. You're in line for gospel because sinner is who Jesus came to die for. Sinner is who Jesus came to forgive. Sinner is who Jesus came to say, I will make you son or daughter. Do not reject your very humanity by saying, I'm not a sinner. And don't reject your hope of the gospel by saying, I'm not a sinner. Yes, you were born in sin. Yes, our flesh remains and we still sin. But sinner is who Jesus loves and died for. Okay, I left zero time for questions. Surprise, surprise, with my only one-page handout. If you do have questions, we are going to do a Q&A. I'm sorry, I did not mean to run us out of time for questions today. But if you have questions, let's talk or remember them for our future Q&A. We'll go ahead and end there. Today is ministry fair, and so if you would please leave the tables where they are, because we're going to set them up in this break right now for our ministry fair. So leave the tables, but if you can help with chairs, that'd be awesome. And we'll see you in the worship service.